Accession number 28353, Reel 12.
We were talking about the aftermath of the Aeronautical Society speech by
yes.
Mike Graydon, and as I say, I think it was very difficult for him because there wasn't a natural successor to him at that stage, and of course he ended up doing a very long stint as CAS, sort of about five and a half years, which is a very long stint. Because there wasn't a natural successor, the death of John Thompson, the resignation of Sandy Wilson. But he must have known that before he made the speech, and therefore I think to make the speech and then climb down slightly was a sadness for the Air Force, because I think it put us even more on the defensive for at least a while before either a change of Secretary of State made the relationship very difficult. We were also still fighting against Hart and Walker. Walker had by this time retired, but he was arguing to the Secretary of State, Rifkin, that he should be given a four-star appointment. He retired as a three-star, but he should be given a four-star appointment as an Inspector General of all three services. And now, of course, this brought the other two services in, and fortunately, that galvanised the three chiefs, I think, to go to the Secretary of State and say, you know, we're not having this. This is quite impossible. And clearly it would have been an absolute disaster for the Royal Air Force, because Walker would have got everything that he tried to get during defence cost studies but hadn't got. He'd had a completely second bite of the cherry, and it would have completely undermined the Chief of Air Staff, Mike Graydon, at the time. And I think had Walker got that job, I think it's my view that Graydon would have resigned. I would have resigned as the assistant chief. I think most of the Air Force board at the time would have just resigned en masse, because it would have been just quite unacceptable. But fortunately, because we now had the support of the Navy and the Army, who didn't want this chap as the Inspector General either, we managed to persuade Rifkin that that wasn't the right answer, and fortunately it was done away with. And thereafter, Walker sort of went away, really. He ceased to become a great player on the scene. That really was my sort of time as assistant chief. I left in sort of November 95, so I did just over the year, before going on to the central staffs to become the deputy chief of defence staff for programmes and personnel. That was therefore in sort of the back end of 95.
Yes.
When the CDS of the day was Inge, the Secretary of State was Portillo, the Vice Chief was initially a chap called Willis, Air Chief Marshal John Willis, and he was succeeded by Admiral Peter Abbott. I enjoyed a lot working for Field Marshal Inge. I thought he was an excellent CDS to work for. I really enjoyed it. People had said that he was quite difficult. He used to shout at people and things, but I never found him anything other than the most courteous man imaginable. I thought he was a delight to work for. Really was. Humorous, understanding, people-orientated. No, I thought he was a jolly nice man to work for. I enjoyed it. Portillo, I thought, was probably the best Secretary of State I worked for. Didn't necessarily share all of his aspirations and things of that nature, but for a man to work for, I thought he was excellent. You knew where you stood. He asked extremely searching questions. He would make up his mind. He would give you a decision. He would explain why his decision was sometimes at variance to your recommendation. And you knew once he'd made his mind up, made a decision, that was it. The problem was dealt with. You wouldn't have to come back to it again, even if it meant arguing with the Treasury, because he could beat the Chancellor every time. And it was really good to work for a man like that. He wasn't an arrogant man. People always said that he had great, very arrogant, but he wasn't in his dealings with the staff in MOD. Everybody said he used special advisers. Well, he did, but not nearly to the extent that Rifkin had done. They were far less in evidence, so I thought he was by far away the best Secretary of State that I had worked for in terms of his ability to make things happen if that was the decision that he'd taken. So I enjoyed it.
May I just take you up, please? He could beat the Treasury. He didn't have to worry about the Treasury now. That was not Lamont, was it? We're now into Clark's.
Yes, I expect we probably are.
So are you suggesting that Portillo carried more weight in the various cabinet subcommittees or whatever it was?
Well, obviously enough, because, as I say, if he said this is the way we're going, you knew it was a done deal. That he would drive it through. There was, he would overcome whatever reluctance there was in the Treasury, because he came from being Chief Secretary of the Treasury. He knew the workings inside out. He clearly had Prime Ministerial support. He was, well thought of at that stage. And so, as I say, working for him was a real pleasure. I'll come on to Hoon, who I thought also is and was a very good Secretary of State, but whereas Portillo, as I say, could beat the Chancellor, Hoon has never been able to beat the Chancellor and has always required the Prime Minister to weigh in on his behalf, and the Prime Minister isn't always prepared to do that because, again, of the relationship that he has with
his own
with
Chancellor.
Brown. Yeah. Or lack of relationship that he has with his own Chancellor. So, I thought Portillo was an excellent Secretary of State. The programmes and personnel portfolio under the DCS P&P is a huge one. It looks after, or in those days it looked after programmes. By programmes I mean balance of investment across defence. So should we buy or spend our money on equipment or running costs? Should we spend, if we are going to spend our money on equipment, is it carriers or is it tanks or is it aeroplanes? Not necessarily precisely what model and mark of aeroplane or tank or ship, that was obviously the systems area, but certainly the balance of investment across all three services, across defence as a whole, came under the programmes element of DCS P&P, so broad in itself, but then also came all personnel policy, to the extent that this post chaired the what was called the principal personnel officers of all three services, so the heads of personnel within the single services work to the DCS P&P on personnel policy. The PAOs, the principal administrative officers, which looked after logistics for all three services, worked under the chairmanship of the P&P. Medical, he had line management responsibility for the Surgeon General. He had line management responsibility for the Defence Services Secretary. He was responsible for the policy of reserve forces and cadets. And whoever occupied the post was always in attendance at all finance and planning management group meetings. That was the sort of the senior committee in the MOD chaired by the permanent secretary. He was in attendance at all chiefs of staff meetings and in attendance at all defence council meetings. So it really was a very broad spectrum of responsibilities. And it was in the aftermath, clearly still, of defence cost studies, where greater centralisation, so even really more coming in under the various deputy chiefs of defence staff. For example, in the programmes area, we had seen the centralisation of all the single service plans directorates. So whereas when I was the assistant chief of air staff, the director of air plans worked directly to me, now the director of air plans, along with the director of navy plans and army plans, answered directly, not directly, but through a two-star to the Deputy Chief of Defence Staff for programmes. Within the programme area, I think we had got ourselves into a position where a tremendous bow wave of expenditure within the equipment plan. Over time, and certainly when I was doing the assistant chief job, the then central programming staff had fought very hard to drive up the percentage of the defence budget which was spent on new equipment, which is extremely laudable, and I know that Mike Graydon was very keen and the Royal Air Force benefited quite substantially from it, but we had managed to drive up the amount of spent on the equipment side to something like 46% of the defence budget, which was unusually high in historical terms. But that undoubtedly had got an impact on the running cost elements, and therefore the three single services were starting to hurt quite badly in terms of money for things like recruiting, retention, flying hours, activity levels, property management, looking after their estate, and so forth. So quite a conflict to be resolved between the single services and the centre on how do we continue to run this expanding equipment programme, at the same time provide money for the single services to maintain their estate, keep recruiting, keep retaining, provide activity levels and so forth for the services. And that being one of the key responsibilities of balancing across defence under the VCSP&P where we put our money. And so an interesting responsibility.
One thing that I'll just quickly say that Michael Graydon said was that I asked him something about along the lines of what was the overriding thing that happened in your 4.5 years. And he said, well, what we managed to do was be traded off a huge reduction in manpower from, I think, 89,000 to 59, or whatever the figures were meant to be, in return for re-equipping the RAF to do what it now had to do, because Gulf War I had shown that we needed more.
Yes.
Smart
yes.
weaponry, etc.,
yes.
etc. Et
yes.
And he sort of presented it in the way of saying the manpower will go from X to Z, but we want the weapons.
Yes.
And that basically was the deal that was done.
Yeah, and there's no doubt that he championed that, and when he retired, he left the Royal Air Force with an equipment programme which was as good as we'd ever had in our history, really, and has largely stayed on track. There have been clearly one or two frustrations along the way, but that was his undoubted legacy, was actually getting the equipment programme for the Royal Air Force into a really proper, coherent shape and size, with platforms, sensors and weapons coming forward in a balanced sort of way. However, there's no doubt that the result of that, to a degree, and pressure on defence as a whole, meant that the single services then got very badly squeezed as part in terms of running costs. And you've always got to balance the two. And I think probably we just let the pendulum go a little too far. And certainly I felt that by the time I got back to being CNC Strike Command, that, you know, the morale of the front line was, yes, it was wonderful program out there, but frankly, for our airmen who were living in appalling barrack blocks and things of that nature, time it didn't ring their withers to say you've got this fantastic Typhoon coming online in 6 years' time, when they're living in a really scruffy barrack block which we can't afford to repair the plumbing and paint the windows. So I think the pendulum had gone slightly too far, but there's no doubt that, you know, it did put the Air Force equipment program into very, very good shape indeed. I had, as Deputy Chief Defence Staff of Programmes and Personnel, an extremely able two-star in the programming area, a naval Rear Admiral called Essenhigh, who went on to be Chief of Naval Staff. And because a huge amount of pressure out of defence cost studies came onto the personnel side and all sorts of different strands on that, there's no doubt in my 3 years as DCSP&P, more of my time was focused on the personnel function and the logistics function than it was on the programming. I could actually, though I kept a reasonable eye on it, I could leave Essenhigh to look after the programming side, and I think it worked, and it allowed me to focus more time directly on the personnel and logistics function. Because, as I say, the focus was very much on personnel. I suppose recruiting itself was a major problem for the Army, who were not meeting their recruiting targets year on year, which was giving them a huge stretch problem. For the Royal Navy and the Royal Air Force, perhaps our difficulties were more in specialist areas, whether it be aircrew or fighter controllers or systems operators in the Navy, far more a recruiting or retention problem allied to key specialisations, whereas in the Army it was much more of a general thing. So that was something that clearly I worked very closely with the sort of chiefs of personnel within the other two services, the Second Sea Lord, the Adjutant General, and CNC Personnel and Training Command, who, as I say, were all 4-star officers, and I was only a 3-star officer, which made chairing their committee was from time to time quite interesting. One of the other key areas in the personnel thing was the emphasis which was coming on diversity and equal opportunities. Brought about because of the involvement of the Commission of Racial Equality criticising the Army in particular, but Defence as a whole, for being racist in its approach, what they called, same for the police, sort of the institutionalised racism.
This,
yeah,
deadly McPherson word.
Yes, and the CRE coming out and sort of really accusing the armed forces as a result of particular experiences within the household division in the Army. And that took up a lot of time, trying to work with the CRE and the chairman of the CRE to make the necessary improvements in the service to try and increase the percentage of ethnic minority people that we recruited. Very difficult, because although across the nation as a whole we've got something like 7% ethnic diversity, we haven't got anything like 7% of the armed forces from the ethnic minorities. I mean, we're running probably at about 3-3.5%, something of that nature at the moment, perhaps a little higher in certain parts of the Army, but we're not nearly up to the national average, partly because they don't have the confidence, because they keep hearing nasty stories about what goes on in the armed forces, but partly because for many of them it's not a natural thing to be doing in the first place. Yes, if you happen to be a Sikh, you may come from a military sort of environment, but for lots of them, they're just not interested in the armed forces at all. So you can sort of bring the horse to water, but you can't necessarily make it drink. But certainly the services have had to do a great deal in terms of trying to produce greater confidence within the black and Asian communities that they can come and enjoy a harassment-free time in the services. And sadly, we'll still get sort of the odd example where we don't come out particularly well. But I think, in general terms, the atmosphere within all three services is one of great tolerance of equal opportunities and diversity. On the equal opportunities front, obviously huge pressure to open up more and more of the armed forces to the employment of women. And we saw during my time as DCSPMP sort of opening up of many more jobs to women in the Air Force. It's now sort of up at about 99%. In the Army and Navy, it's in the Army it's about 70%. In the Navy, it's a bit above 70%. So really, very few jobs now not open to women, and that's good as well. But huge pressure.
Is that really a good thing?
Yes, I think it is. I think it's absolutely right and proper, though, that the infantry and submarines, for example, the Royal Air Force Regiment and my own service, have not been opened up to women, because I think there are very good reasons why they shouldn't be employed in those particular fields. But at sea, in ships in general, in aircraft, and in the less than infantry roles, then I think women are showing that they can be just as good as their male counterparts, or if not better in some respects. I think the only, obviously there is a problem, in as much that by and large you don't get the same return of service from them as you get from their male counterparts, because they do tend clearly to have families at some stage, and some of them, well, quite a large percentage, having had a family, will not come back into the respective service. So yes, you will not get the same return of service from them, and that has to be a disadvantage. Equally, I suppose, if you have in any one unit too many in key appointments, and for example you suddenly go off on an operation and any woman beyond a certain stage in pregnancy who cannot then be deployed, you could find that within a unit you lost two or three key executives from a unit, which would have an impact on its operational effectiveness if you suddenly had to post new people in order for that unit to deploy. So I think there are disadvantages, but by and large it's not a bad thing.
And can you explain the reasoning, and I apologise if this is an obvious question or with an obvious answer, why women should not be deployed in submarines, for example? I know it's a naval point, but submarines, the RAF regiment and frontline infantry.
Well, it is to do with the relationship. You build an infantry or Royal Air Force regiment, let's take those together, you build your effectiveness on a four-man team. That's the minimum size of team, an infantry section, four men or four people, and you then build up to 8s, to 16, to 32s and so forth, and eventually you get a battalion or a squadron or whatever it happens to be. That four-person unit has got to work together with complete trust, confidence in each other and so forth, and once you introduce a mixed gender into that, you get relationships. And the moment you get relationships, the trust and unity of that team starts to break down. You cannot say that a woman cannot pass the physical tests required in strength, endurance and that sort of thing, because you'll always get, you won't get many of them, but you will always get one or two who can pass whatever bar you tell them they've got to jump. They will get over it, because they will train, and you know, there are women who have just as much strength as the average man, but they're few and far between. But the moment you get a mixed team, you will always get relationships, whether you like it or not, and that will break down the ethos, the trust and so forth, which must exist in that four-person team. You won't get very many women who can pass the physical endurance tests, and therefore if you are looking for any degree of parity between numbers, you won't get it without reducing your standards. And so the danger is, A, the fabric will break because of relationships, and secondly, once you allow them in and say yes, it will be very difficult to maintain the standards of strength and so forth that are required, because there will be huge pressure once you've said yes to lowering the standard, and that's why I think we have managed to resist it, and it took a lot of arguing, but we got it through, and right and proper too. Submarines is slightly different. I think submarines is to do with nuclear safety, nuclear radiation, the just, I mean, although it's, I mean, there is a little bit of radiation shift, you know, it's no worse than wearing an aluminous dial on your watch, but there is this medical fear for the unborn child, and, you know, what could happen in the stages of pregnancy when even the potential mother doesn't know she's pregnant. And you've also got the whole question of privacy. A submarine is, again, it would be very, very difficult to give any privacy to the women. Now, you might say, why do they want it? You know, they live in a modern world and things of that nature. I personally, for one, am not enthusiastic about not giving men or women a degree of privacy in their own, you know, genders.
How are they able to have that on a smallish frigate, which they're not able to have on a nuclear-powered hunter-killer submarine?
Well, obviously, the smaller the ship, the more difficult it is. But if you, I've not been to sea in an SSBN. I've been to sea in an SSN, and I mean the degree of privacy is very low indeed on an SSN. I think even on a little tight sort of a offshore patrol vessel, it's better on a small ship than it is on a submarine.
Okay. Yeah. One final question for you, if I may, then. If there hadn't been this political small p social pressure to have this relentless equality thing going, which we've had going now for 30 years, if that hadn't transpired as much as it has, or had not happened at all, the armed forces wouldn't have women in the way that they do now, would they?
No, probably not. But I think, for example, this goes back to my time as sort of ACAS. The Air Force had opened up some of its flying roles to women, not frontline, but support aircraft, search and rescue helicopters, and so forth. The Navy had been forced to take women in surface ships because of political correctness, and they had done that against their better judgment. It didn't work early on because they spread them too thinly across too many ships, and it doesn't work under those circumstances. They found that for it to work, you've got to have a critical mass in a ship, and ideally you've got to have women across the rank structure. Initially, of course, they had no senior NCO type women in ships because there weren't any, so they only had either very junior ratings or young officers, and they didn't have the rank spectrum which they needed within a critical mass to make it work. Now it does work. We eventually, in my service, chose to open up more of the frontline flying appointments, not because of political correctness, although I think we would have been forced down that route eventually, but because we actually were running short of male recruits for aircrew at that stage, and therefore we had to open it up if we were to get the numbers of the right quality. So I'm sure it would have happened through political pressure, but we actually opted for it in advance because we needed the people. The Army, I think, would have been slower to embrace women to the degree that they now have. But you're right, political pressure was placed upon them. Yeah. So, yeah, you're right, the services would not have moved as far as they've moved without political pressure.
And therefore, as this was not a service and efficiency led move, apart from the fact that you couldn't get men possibly in some cases in the Air Force and in the Navy, I've heard as well, do you think that the armed forces' general efficiency has been compromised in any way as a result of following this route?
I don't think the Air Force's has been. And I don't think that the Navy's has been. You'd have to talk to, I think, an Army senior commander. I think there has been a migration of the women again into the, this is going to sound bad, into the perhaps the slightly softer jobs in the Army. And whether, therefore, some of those parts of its organisation are less effective than they were, I don't know. You'd have to ask them. But it's not obvious. It's not obvious. So I wouldn't say without any doubt that there has been a reduction in effectiveness.
Thank you. This might be an opportune moment to change tapes, but virtually at the end,
right.
So I'll do that if I may.